I am Plante on the line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. One of the best books of the year is a new book from Christopher Chung, Under the White Gaze, Solving the Problem of Race and Representation in Canadian Journalism. A lot of us would like to think that the newsrooms in Canada are reflective of the country's multiculturalism, or at the very least hip, to representing the country's population in the news that the media covers. Mr. Chung, who joins me now, points out that a lot of the journalism in this country seems to present people of color as clichés and rarely as complex individuals. There's the painting with broad brushes as to what communities there are in this country, what they look like, what they eat, what they celebrate, and what concerns them. Chris dismantles a lot of that thinking and provides great examples of recent, as well as some local stories that perhaps miss the mark. There are some stories he cites that I thought were reflective of a group or community, but got me thinking about how they weren't necessarily accurate and how some might have been done better. Chris is not immune from his critical and probing eye. He looks at stories he's framed in the past and look back at how different they might be with the skills he also shares in the book. One will find ways in which we, who consume the media, might read, watch, and listen to the journalism around us better, and even critically. The idea that intersectionality is critical to combating stereotypes is one of the most important aspects of the book, and whether you're an aspiring or seasoned journalist, you'll want to read this book for perhaps a new perspective. I'll also ask Chris about how he's handled criticism he's received for his work, some of it not so constructive, even nasty. Christopher Chung is a staff reporter at the Tyee who previously wrote for Metro and the Vancouver Courier. He is highly acclaimed for his reporting on urban culture, inequality, and life in Metro Vancouver's diasporas. He's received two Jack Webster Awards and holds a Master's of Journalism from the University of British Columbia. This new book is published by Purich Books, which is an imprint of UBC Press. We spoke last week. Please welcome back to the Plante Online program, Christopher Chung. Mr. Chung, good morning.
Thank you so much for having me again.
Thanks for joining us. This idea of the white gaze is a fascinating one because I think it's easier not to talk about than acknowledge that it's there. As a writer, as a journalist, even today, how does it manifest itself? I mean, one of the things that I think a lot of people who pick up the book might think that one might be, say, prone to self-censor. Is that something that not just you, but some of your colleagues talk about, say?
Oh, very much so. Thankfully, we started to get more data on who's in the journalism industry. So, journalism is a very white industry, and that goes for the makeup of who's in newsrooms and also, as I argue in the book, the point of view of how news is being told. I think anybody who is a journalist of color who comes into this industry, like we can't help but think about race and talk about race, whether it's, I might be the only person of color in the newsroom, or like, why is this group being singled out again in the story, or why do they run such a cheesy story, or, how come my editor is treating me like I'm an expert on something to do with my background, like ancient China or something like that. So, I think that idea that, news is impartial, it doesn't come from a point of view, is a bit artificial. News always comes from a point of view. Like, we can try to be fair, we can try to be accurate. But depending on who the journalist is, who the publication is catered to, all of that will come out in the coverage. I think very early on for me, I was just, growing up in Vancouver, I was just really happy whenever there was a person of color who was in the news. And I think that was a kind of a first but like shallow metric of how I counted diversity. It's just, yes or no, is there a person of color in the news? But over time, I started to think about other questions like, when we do show up in stories, is it the same kinds of stories over and over again? Do we get to be the main character sometimes, or are we just being talked about? And when it comes to this gaze, are people of color just treated as people, or in the story, we're distanced as being different or ethnic or exotic, and that can be in good or bad ways.
And so I'm sure you've had a lot of discussions with your colleagues. How do you get away from it? And Thinking about people just as people, I mean, that's an important, I guess, first step, an important start. But you lose sight of these things sometimes, don't you? I mean, when you're covering so many things in the course of a week, I guess the question I really have, Chris, is does it really come up every day for you, with every story for you?
It is something that I think everybody should have in the back of their minds. It is very difficult on a day-to-day basis, especially for reporters who might be working for some online outlets that are not, it's not daily news. It's like by the minute, like hourly news. And at that point, you don't really have a chance to slow down and maybe think about it for a particular story. I think for me, when I cover groups that I don't belong to, the times that I feel like I do the most inauthentic job is when I'm being rushed. So it does take time to learn from a group. It does take time to build relationships with sources, especially those who have been misrepresented or left out of news. For me, it's always great when I do have experts that I can go to, that I can run something by that I'm not really sure about. Like, hey, is this the right spelling for something? Or here's a paragraph that I wrote. Does this feel authentic to, family life in a particular community? So this is something that takes constant conversations. Like I would hope that newsrooms have regular discussions about this, every quarter or every year. But it is very difficult on a day to day or like hour to hour basis to put out news that is representative.
There's a page in the book, page 149, where you have a list of things that one could do. I mean, there's a lot in this book that's useful, but I single that page out because these are suggestions that you make on how to get to know one's neighborhood better, not just your own, but, say other neighborhoods in the city or any city that you're living in, that you could go about and say, just change your habits in terms of pop into places, get to know the place, not just in those peak times, say, where everybody else is there, but the other times as well. I'm sure a lot of readers will tell you of this book, Chris, that there's a lot that's useful in it. I found that particularly useful, and whether one's a journalist or not, I mean, those are great suggestions that you make.
I think I know which the page you're talking about in the chapter about geography and maps. Mm. Is that right?
Yeah, right. That's
yeah.
Right.
So I think everybody has their own mental map of the place that they live, and it's going to be different from the mental map that like me and you. We're going to have different ideas of which places are important or where we go to. And I feel like for newsrooms, especially if they're working on such an accelerated timeline, it's very easy for us to just to stick to what we know. And I think for me as a reporter in Vancouver, I do have the advantage of having grown up here and being familiar with different neighborhoods, and I like to hang out in different areas. So if I see a place that's not covered very often, like I automatically know that like, hey, like this is a place that requires more attention. In the book, in that particular chapter, I give the example of everybody really liking to cover those up-and-coming neighborhoods and mm-hmm. thinking that there was nothing that existed there before. And I give the example of having covered, Ernest Ice Cream. When I first opened on Fraser Street, right. Everybody was really excited yeah. about it. I hadn't spent very much time on that particular stretch of Fraser. And so when I did a story about how that area was starting to be like a booming place, I took everything that the business owners there, the new business owners there, said for granted. Like that, hey, like, it wasn't a sleepy place. Like, we were being brave and choosing to invest in a riskier place like this that's, off the beaten path. And then over time, I realized, oh, crap, like, this is actually a place that has a lot of history. The Vietnamese newspaper is there. There's a number of Filipino businesses there. There is a Polish community center there. So I had, in writing my first story, I had kind of erased the presence of a lot of groups that were there. And I think this is a trap that a lot of people can fall into when there is some buzz around an area. And unfortunately, it is racialized places. It is working class places that are usually getting erased in these stories.
So I live a half a block or just in from, just off of Fraser from that ice cream shop you just mentioned. And so I read that chapter with interest because you do, in the book, rethink what you wrote then and now as to your thinking now. And I found that incredibly refreshing, you're frank about what you thought then and how you'd go about writing that story if you were writing it today, say.
Yeah, it is very embarrassing, but I think it's kind of like a diary, right? Like if you are putting out, like pieces every day or like every week, you can look back even a week or a month and see that, you feel like you didn't do as good of a job as you thought you did. And I guess that's kind of a good thing because it shows that you've had some growth. So, I tried to pay my dues after that by writing a news story about the history of the neighborhood.
There've been a couple books over the last year or so that books that talk about Vancouver, or Vancouver's neighborhoods, or the history of Vancouver. And I always note, and I noted this with both authors when they came on the podcast, that the area where I live seems to not appear in books like theirs. And you get typical response, well, there's only so much one can cover in a book like this, or one architecture expert was actually quite frank that it wasn't as interesting, say. I guess the thinking of that page in the book that I just mentioned, how do you respond to say journalists or media outlets who say there isn't the time or the resources to do what you suggest in the book?
For journalists, I think it's their job to do that. If you can't do it today, you can certainly do it tomorrow or in a month or like if you're at a pretty stable place in a year's time. I've had stories that I've had kind of on the back burner for years, and thankfully because I've had the same employer, I've been able to go back to them. But I like what you mentioned about those books because I felt the same way about a bunch of Vancouver coffee table books, whether it's like, Guides of the City or like here's a cookbook that's representative of our cuisine. And I didn't want to be a too much of an upstart and call them out, but I just couldn't resist one for the author of like an East Van cookbook. And I reached out I said like, hey, how come you ignored the restaurants from these places, these particular neighborhoods, mostly in the east and south southern pockets of the city?
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, oh, can you name them for me? And then I did name some, and he's like, we tried, but they didn't get back to us. So I don't know if he actually tried. Maybe he did. A lot of the recipes from that East Bend cookbook came from, like, well-known restaurants where chefs are – it's more of like the fine dining celebrity chef
right.
kind of a place.
Yeah.
Even if I was to take what he said at face value, if he did try that is what happens sometimes with journalism. We do reach out to communities that might not really know what we're up to because we haven't really bothered to invest our coverage there. Maybe they, their native language is a language other than English. It does take a lot more time to be able to get them to share. So I think it's obvious when those blank spots are there, but I think it's also our responsibility to interrogate them when we notice them.
That's something you talk about in the book is how to talk to people. And as someone who's done this podcast for a while now, I'm always curious to know how people get other people to say things. Is that something that you're finding even now challenging? Because you do talk, in your work, you try to be as representative as possible and careful as possible and humane as possible. Do you still find it hard to find people to talk to, say?
I think it can be easy to find people to talk to, but to find someone who is the right fit for your story can be really difficult. Even if you're looking for somebody who's marginalized in particular, who might be experiencing homelessness, or it's like a renter who's about to be dem evicted or whatever.
Yeah.
The people who will speak up. Like, it's hard to find, like, how do you begin to find somebody like that? If you go to a social service agency or some activist group, they will trot out somebody who is the best candidate, who is very well-versed in these issues, to do it. But they still, I think, have a bit of privilege. And when I'm trying to get somebody who is, you know, most impacted by something that is happening in the city, maybe it's gentrification or whatever, again, like with the language issues, who might be very shy to talk to media, mm-hmm. who doesn't really want to expose the details, of their life or of their poverty, mm-hmm. You know, why would they want to talk to, you, in such a public way? So I think when I do a story that is like that, that does have some kind of, like, you know, David and Goliath element to it, and I want to speak to the person who is the underdog, but I feel in my gut that it's, like, not the right person. It is very hard to find who I think is the right person in that particular neighborhood.
I found reading your work over the years that you managed to find people that we haven't heard from before, which is great, but your ability to get them to share things or go on the record, if you will, have their picture taken even. One can see the work that it takes to say just to convince them to do that. Did you find that you're spending a lot of time doing that sort of work, say?
Yeah. It cannot be a hit-and-run interview. I think you need to... It has to be more of a two-way street when it comes to interviews. You know, I would think, you know, we talk about consent when we're doing academic research. But for that kind of thing, there are forms. People know what they're getting into. They're signing something. But for journalism, it's very, very different. You just get a call out of the blue or get approached out of the blue. Nothing is signed, and somebody will just agree to do the interview if they feel like it. But I think most people don't really know what that might entail, like having their name, having their picture published, being online nowadays. This is a record that's going to be there forever. So I think it is on the onus for a journalist. If we are talking to somebody who is, we can see that they're marginalized in some way, it is our job to let them know, like, hey, like, are you okay with us publicizing, you know, where you live, the details of your life? Mm-hmm. If you do have something in your past that might have consequences if it's exposed like that, whether it is something that's legal or even something to do with your family that might make them upset. Like, it's important to let them know that. Obviously, for a politician, they're somebody who should know how media works, so we don't offer them that same courtesy. Mm-hmm. But I do think that back and forth is important, and letting them know, like, hey, this is the story that I'm telling. This is your part in it. I would love to tell your picture. Here are the details that I plan to include. Are you okay with that? So that's for pieces where I do see that there might be some risk for the source and then a marginalized source, I'm very happy to offer them that kind of courtesy.
Another fascinating thing as I was reading the book is you cite some stories in the local media, especially that you know that I remember over the last few years, and you use them as examples, say of things that we need to watch out for, or in some cases, you call them out for, say, certain ways that they're framed. And I love going into the notes and finding those stories again. What's the reaction been from your colleagues, say, who might have gotten called out in the book for certain stories?
Yeah, I at one point I was wondering if I should make up stories as examples, but I thought people would like to know real stories of examples when certain things I've pointed out as being under the white gaze. So, like, I really didn't want to be mean-spirited about it unless it's like a really, really silly story. Mm. So there was a story that I quote in the book about how the Associated Press said congee was the new way to eat rice. I thought that was ridiculous, and it deserved being made fun of. But as you mentioned earlier, I do analyze my own work. Like, I want to show that anybody can adopt a white gaze. Anybody, when we're putting out journalism at this kind of a pace, even if we have good intentions, we can make mistakes. But inevitably, there are journalists whose work is, like, cited in the book, and some of the examples even come from some friends of mine. There haven't been too many examples where I've been confronted about including someone's work, but there was a time where a friend wrote some stories that I felt was really stigmatizing. And when I met up with them over bubble tea, like, I was writing the book at the time, mm-hmm. and it was really, really eating at me that I had written something about my friend's work, and I was, like, sitting in front of them and you know, not having disclosed it.
Yeah.
So I did bring it up. And the surprising thing was, you know, they told me that they felt the same way about their coverage of this particular topic. But they said that their editor really, really wanted them to write the story. And I think that shows the kind of power dynamic that exists in newsrooms. Like, you know, it is great if you hire people of color who do have skills with, you know, say a particular language or some kind of cultural literacy.
Yeah.
But if your editor is from a different group and has a certain view that they want to assign you a story that's in fitting of that view, that can make that reporter of color like very powerless and almost feel kind of used when they write that story. So so even though it was a stigmatizing story, that person's name was on it. It wasn't really their framing at the end of the day, and I think that happens quite a lot.
So then, how do we address that then? As a media consumer, I'm curious to know how though that can't happen again. As a journalist, I'm sure you'd want, say, newsrooms to not do things like that. What's the solution to something like that?
Yeah, it is very difficult, especially now when newsrooms have a lot more, existential things to think about,
sure.
Their ad budgets are being taken out by online advertising and whatnot. I would hope that the environment is comfortable enough for a reporter to speak up. In a perfect world, editors would be more reflective about this. It is good that in an online environment, people can, comment, share it on social media, and that's something that's useful for reporters, is we can say, like, oh, hey, like, this thing that we put out is actually experiencing a lot of backlash. So I think in general, it's just an attitude that newsrooms, some of them might have forgotten to be in service of their community, and that's not just being top down, like putting out content, but also listening to what comes back from the ground up.
You mentioned the comments just a moment ago. How have you dealt with the abuse that you've gotten over your work? Because, I mean, you do talk about a number of instances where you've gotten feedback that's been less than positive about your work. I mean, do you avoid the comments altogether?
Yeah, on certain forums, I've tried to avoid them. Some are easier in some ways than others. So, you know, I have gotten the typical, like, go back to China, or, like, you know, this is terrible reporting. People who are very outraged. And that hurts, but it's easier to ignore because I know these people are being really unreasonable. But what I'm more frustrated about are the people who think that they're being progressive when they're trying to shut me down. So, you know, when they say that I'm racist for talking about race, there's only one human race. I'm calling, by calling attention to people's differences, I'm actually creating more racism. So I think that stuff is, like, it really bothers me, because, you know, those people think that they somehow are, like, morally superior. But, I guess this book is one way that I've tried to respond to that. Like, you know, one of the comments I've gotten the most is that, you know, stop writing stories about race because there are more important life and death issues, such as climate change. And I thought that was really silly because, you know, climate change intersects with so many other things, like class, for example, race. And this is something that we are seeing more and more now, whether it's, with extreme weather events like the heat wave and whatnot. So I think people need to have a more more complex understanding of how race intersects with different issues, whether that's whether it's class or gender or whatnot. As a journalist, I'm not the one who's creating these issues. These are issues that are out there in society, and we are merely reporting on them. So I think it'd be really silly if we said that we shouldn't report on wealth or poverty because we're all human. Like, we know that that is something that's a divide that people segregate each other on, and I think it's the same with race.
You talk in the book about shutdown commands. You mentioned Andy Yan, who I admire a great deal for his work. That's something that he's encountered as well, that journalists like you have encountered, right?
Yeah. Andy at SFU has been great about this because, as a planner, like, one of the issues that he faced a lot was people saying that it was racist to talk about foreign money in the Vancouver real estate market and the Canadian real estate market.
Mm-hmm.
It was very difficult to parse that conversation because people saw that, oh, you're talking about foreign money? Oh, well, that's racist. Rather than talking about, like, hey, this, you know, we're talking about policy here. There are racists who want to ban foreign money, but there's also people who are people of color who would like to see foreign money banned in Canada as well. And so I think, you know, journalists need to do a good job in parsing some of those issues for their audiences. Because otherwise, it could be very easy to scapegoat a particular group. Back then, it was Chinese nationals,
mm-hmm.
but it can also be very easy to ignore what is a very serious issue of housing unaffordability here as well. So there's two sides to that spectrum.
We've talked already about the contracting media landscape, if you will, in this country, in the city. Could you have imagined, say, over a decade now since you've been in the business, how it's contracted as it has?
Absolutely not. I think that was a bit of naivety on my part, but I think even for people in the know, they couldn't have predicted what would happen. I was very naive in the beginning. I thought I was just kind of had the attitude of an artist. Like, I thought I could just make these beautiful pieces and put them out there and somebody would pay for them.
Mm-hmm.
But the early publications that I worked for, the Vancouver Courier and Metro, both of them are gone now. And Metro used to be a very common sight in newspaper bins by transit stations, along with 24 and the Georgia Strait and others. I remember Metro, there was even an actual person with a vest who would hand them out at transit stations.
Yeah.
And that was something, when I was writing for them in late 2017, like that was something that was still happening. And so both of those publications are gone. We've seen, places like the Vancouver Sun and the Province, massive newsrooms, decimated. We've seen, CBC, as well. There's layoffs there while executives pocket funding. There is a lot that's pessimistic. People say that it's merely the dependence on print advertising going down and that's taking a huge chunk out of newsrooms' budgets. But then we see places like Daily Hive, people made fun of them in the beginning when they were Vancity Buzz for not being very journalistic.
Yeah.
But they have improved over the years, and they've also been able to master a lot of those local clients when it comes to advertising. So they've actually made it work while a lot of older publications haven't. So we're seeing a lot of change. The place that I work for, Bataille, is reader-funded, and I think that's really been a big part of our success. We see a lot more online outlets now and with varying degrees of success. And I think there is a long game that's being played over here, but I think the problem is that every year there is some new curveball that's thrown at us. So
yeah.
A recent one is that we can't share news articles on Facebook or Instagram anymore because of the ban from Meta. That is not something that we've been able to fathom. So there's changes like this all the time. It's really just a matter of trying to ride each of these waves. In this book, I talk about representation, and that's unfortunately that's something that I think people might be casting to the side because of these other threats to the news.
Yeah, it's probably not the priority for the managers or the people that own these publications.
I would. If I can just get one quick one there, I would love to argue that having an expanded audience of people who haven't been reading you before would be helpful, but that might not be top of mind for them.
Exactly. I mean, that's the idea that I think a lot of people think, that being representative might not be profitable. But as you argue in the book, it can be, right?
I believe so. And I think we're seeing a huge shift in, audience habits. Like, when I first started working for the Taii, even though, I had started within the second decade of their existence, people still found being online only very novel.
Yeah.
And yet that's something we've accepted more and more now. People are used to donating to online publications and then getting e-newsletters. And it is a lot of these, I guess, younger outlets that do, you know, without as much institutional baggage, they seem to be the ones that are more nimble and more open-minded when it comes to approaching issues of diversity.
How have your own habits of media consumption, how have they changed over the years?
Yeah, I do try to read everything.
I find the same for myself, that you know, I do try to read everything, listen to everything, watch everything. But it has changed in a certain way. Like, we used to get the newspaper at our house every morning. That doesn't happen anymore, but I find I go to the Sun's website or the Globe and Mail's website during the day, but not at the same time, say.
I'm always very curious when I see, my younger cousins, I'm wondering, are they getting everything off of TikTok? Mm. Are they getting everything off of Instagram cards that are based off of the news? I think there is still a gravitation of people towards having some sort of linear reading experience. I think that's why newsletters have taken off, because people like that connection with the publication. They like being able to read something from beginning to the end. I used to have a pretty well-curated Twitter feed of people that I follow, but I felt that over time, as the algorithm has changed under Musk, that I've gotten a lot more crap in there.
Sure.
So that's been difficult. I'm trying to make it work with Blue Sky, but I do like going, you know, I can't help but like things that evoke the print experience. So I do like going to the Guardian homepage. I do like going to the New York Times homepage. I do like to lurk on certain Reddit threads that are curated by people. It is something that's in flux, but I think that's just a reflection of the landscape itself being in flux.
I do still like going to, even though I don't get a physical paper at the house, I still like the Globe and Mail thing where you can flip through the pages. Or any of the other newspapers. You don't even have to have a subscription to read, say, The Sun or you mentioned The Guardian. If you use your VPL, your Vancouver Public Library card, you can see that online.
And yeah, that's exactly how I read it.
Yeah, I mean, I just love the fact that you can flip through as if you're reading the actual paper. But I like looking at, you know, where stories are placed and what's on the front page or what's below the fold. I guess I'm old-fashioned that way.
Yeah, I think there is something about us as people that we like that kind of experience, that kind of storytelling and how it's presented to us. The Globe has wonderful visual designs. Yeah. Unfortunately, that's not something that's easily translated to the webpage, but they do a very good job of the physical copy. Mm. Yeah, I don't listen to the radio that much, but whenever I am driving to an interview and I have it on, being online so much, it is really nice to be able to hear somebody just tell me the news, and having a diverse diet as well. Whether I'm listening to like CBC or the AM frequencies, like it's a very, very different tone. And even when I listen to Fairchild Radio, like the Cantonese channel, like seeing what topics people care about, like bubble to the top like that, and have it be different from platform to platform is really fascinating.
I'm sure I've asked you this before, but you know, these things change just as your job changes or the landscape changes. When a young person comes up to you now and says they want to do what you do, what do you tell them?
Yeah, I would be very frank with them to let them know like how difficult this is. And I really don't want to be that gatekeeper who's just like, oh, the industry, you know, isn't what it used to be. I think anybody who's really, really into this kind of stuff, whether they have a particular issue they care about, or it's just a simple matter of, strengthening democracy and keeping people informed, I think those people, you know, I won't be able to stop them from entering the industry in any way. I actually have a cousin who wants to do this, so it's been interesting to have a personal experience with that. Mm-hmm. Like letting people know like what they're getting into. If you were to go to some J school journals and school classrooms today, there is a lot of doom and gloom. But I think there isn't as much emphasis on the innovation that is happening. So I, like, from when I started, a little bit over 10 years ago now, there are definitely a lot more publications and a lot more job postings even than I saw before. And these are from the completely different outlets and, like, very, very different jobs. Like, the Globe was hiring people who do, like, online audience engagement. There are publications like the Narwhal that did not exist before, podcasts, newsletters, like, all of that is, like, fairly fresh. And I think it is, like, there is a lot of opportunity in this space, and it's going to take young people who might have more literacy, having grown up with those methods, to take them and run with them and do something exciting and new.
I can't tell you how much I enjoyed this book. It's often hard to read in terms of what you're reading about, say, but I can't help but think how useful it is for people today, but people in the future as well. Congratulations, Chris, on writing this book, and continued good luck with it. I so appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much for reading it so closely.
The book is called Under the White Gaze, Solving the Problem of Race and Representation in Canadian Journalism. It's published by Peerage Books, which is an imprint of UBC Press. Its author, Christopher Chung, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.